Iran blames wrong U.S. policies, including its support of Israel, for instability in West Asia. The UN is facing criticism for dropping Israel from its list of shame of child killers again, despite the deaths of nearly 80 Palestinian kids. Also ahead, Ukrainian forces use U.S. HIMARS rocket launchers to strike Russian military targets in Kherson. Local officials confirm multiple casualties. Hello, welcome to SysMuse. Thanks for joining us. The Iranian Foreign Ministry spokesman says wrong policies of the U.S. are the main cause of instability in the West Asia region. Nasser Kanani says that West Asia will be safer and more stable if Washington puts an end to those policies. He said that Washington should end creating division among regional countries and stop pouring arms into the region. The Iranian diplomat called on the U.S. to respect the sovereignty and territorial integrity of regional countries as well. He also said the U.S. should stop backing Israel, as the regime is the biggest source of instability and organized terror in West Asia. Kanani said that Washington's unwavering support for the regime is a clear proof that the U.S. claim of seeking peace in the region is false. The Iranian Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdollahian is in Italy for an official visit. During his first day in Rome, he met with his Italian counterpart, representatives of the business community, and Iranians residing in the country. Max Civilli reports from Rome.
On Monday, Iran's Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdollahian landed in the Italian capital for a two-day visit to Italy. Amir Abdollahian's first meeting was at Italy's Foreign Ministry, where he met his counterpart Luigi Di Maio to discuss bilateral relations and recent geopolitical developments. Di Maio expressed satisfaction over the resumption of indirect talks between Washington and Tehran over the fate of a 2015 deal. The Iranian minister also stressed the importance of reaching a good, lasting agreement that would see Iran take full economic benefit from the historic agreement, officially known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action. Iran's top diplomat also stated that Tehran is interested in having its natural share in the energy market and thereby helping the international community. His remarks came at a time when the global market is facing high oil prices due to the Western sanctions on Russia for its war on Ukraine. Over the past years, Italy, like other European countries, has lacked an influential role on Iran's most crucial international issues. According to analysts, the choice to maintain a low profile on Iran was driven by the hesitation of Rome in taking a confrontational stand towards the US.
Italy has been playing a diminutive role not only on the Iranian file, but on most international scenarios. Rome's geopolitical line seems to be too far aligned to that of the U.S. administration. It only remains to be seen if Italy's foreign minister's commitment to expand bilateral relations with Iran is more than just a generic pledge.
After holding talks with his counterpart, Amir Abdollahian met tens of Italian businessmen operating in Iran at the Iranian ambassador's residence. Here, entrepreneurs expressed their desire to intensify commercial ties. The Italian embassy in Iran has estimated that the trade volume between the two countries dropped from about 5 billion euros in 2017 to 1.2 billion euros in 2019, following the U.S. reimposition of sanctions. Also on Monday, Iran's top diplomat met with representatives of the Iranian community residing in Italy. On Tuesday, the Iranian minister is slated to hold talks with high-ranking prelates at the Vatican. Max Civilli, Rome.
The United Nations has released its annual report on children and armed conflict, but it has drawn criticism for omitting Israel from the list of shame, despite killing nearly 80 Palestinian children. The Palestinian deaths are among more than 2,500 child killings verified by the UN across the world in 2021, but Israel is not on a blacklist of child killers. The UN chief, Antonio Guterres, has said that Israel will be added to the list for the 2022 report if it repeats its high numbers of violations. That has drawn strong criticism from human rights bodies. They say omitting Israel is another missed opportunity for accountability. The groups say that Israel, year after year, has gone away with committing serious crimes against children with virtual impunity. The UN has in recent years also faced criticism for omitting Saudi Arabia from its child killers list, despite kids being killed in Yemen. Political commentator Moti Abu Musab believes removing Israel from the UN list of child killers amounts to a crime.
Actually, excluding the Israeli occupation from such an investigation and lifting off the Israeli occupation from that list, I think, is a crime itself. Because anyone worldwide has the little bit of a humanity, understands and realizes clearly that the real position and the true position of the Israeli occupation should be at the top of that list. Because Israel has a long history of targeting and killing the Palestinian people as a whole and the Palestinian children specifically. Since the beginning of 2022, more than 13 Palestinian children were killed. In 2021, in the May aggression, more than 67 Palestinian children were slaughtered and buried alive under the rubble of their residential houses after they were striked and bounded by the Israeli airstrikes in full view of the whole world. In the 2014 aggression, as Palestinians commemorate the eighth anniversary of that aggression, more than 550 Palestinian children were killed deliberately by the Israeli occupation.
Ukraine has launched a deadly attack on Russian-controlled Kherson to claim the region. According to pro-Russia authorities, attacks have killed 7 people. However, the Ukrainian military says at least 52 Russian forces have lost their lives. Kiev also says its forces have targeted artillery and armored vehicles, as well as an ammunition depot in the region. Earlier on Sunday, Ukraine urged Kherson's residents to evacuate urgently. Kherson fell to Russian forces in the early weeks of Russia's military operation, which is approaching its 5th month. The region, which is located northwest of the Crimean Peninsula, is strategic in the eastern Donbas region. The Russian president has issued a decree to speed up citizenship for all Ukrainians, more than 4 months after the start of Moscow's offensive in the war-torn country. Vladimir Putin's decree also enables stateless persons permanently residing in Ukraine to obtain Russian citizenship in a simplified manner. Putin had already fast-tracked citizenship for residents of 2 regions in the south and southeast of Ukraine, which are totally or partially under Russia's control. Kiev has condemned the decree as worthless and proof of Putin's aggressive appetites. Foreign Minister Dmytro Kuleba said the decree breaches Ukraine's sovereignty and territorial integrity and is at odds with international law. He said that Ukrainians do not need Russian citizenship, warning that attempts to impose it by force are doomed to fail. A similar decree in 2019 allowed the same simplified citizenship procedure for residents of Ukraine's eastern breakaway regions of Donetsk and Luhansk. Our correspondent Johnny Miller is in Donetsk, eastern Ukraine. He gives us updates on fighting between Ukrainian and Russian forces.
The main focal points seem to be on a number of fronts at the moment. The Russian army is trying to make advances in the northern Donbas region. Currently, they're shelling the cities, the outskirts of the cities where the Ukrainians are dug in around Slavyansk and Kramatorsk. And meanwhile, Russia, of course, continues to hit, as you say, other targets in Ukraine. It's interesting, this propaganda war between Russia and Ukraine, where Russia says that it's hitting military targets, particularly in Shazid Yar, and Ukraine says that it's a civilian target that Russia has hit. Now, you can't really trust either government sources there. You need independent verification to find out just what Russia hit there. It's interesting that Ukrainian media will show pictures of the damage, whereas Russian media will show pictures with damage and military casualties to try and prove that it was a military target. But Russia continues to hit these targets around Ukraine. Also, it's becoming clear that Ukraine is very keen to particularly try and take back the southern region of Kherson. Kherson in the southern region of Ukraine, which Russia took in the opening days of the war, very mixed ethnically between Russians and Ukrainians. And Ukraine has announced that they're very keen, particularly, to take back that region. So that's why you've seen a strike by Ukraine in Kherson last night. and you may well see more strikes by Ukraine in that region as they try and take back particularly the southern region. So while most of the fighting at the moment is still focused in Donbass, you may well see that shift as time goes by, as Ukraine is interested in taking back particularly the southern region of Ukraine.
When it comes to U.S. spending priorities, the numbers seem especially misguided in an era of tight budgets to come. And now lawmakers have once again opted to shower the Pentagon with cash rather than address the country's most pressing issues. Those issues, from poverty and hunger to health care, have left tens of millions of Americans in precarious conditions.
The devastating impact of the coronavirus pandemic and its economic fallout continue to take a toll on the world and provide ample reason to reconsider where taxpayers' money is being spent. Several countries have even come to the conclusion that their budget is better off being spent where it can potentially ameliorate the economic pressure on their citizens. In the U.S., however, while such reassessments are long overdue along with the trillions of dollars Congress and successive administrations have lavished on the Pentagon, lawmakers have decided to once again shower the Pentagon with cash, even more than what it asked for. Interestingly enough, this comes while the massive U.S. arsenal and fighting force deployed worldwide have proven to be powerless against grave, non-military threats to national security. Gas prices in the U.S. are at an all-time high. Rent prices have set records for the last 13 months straight. Inflation is increasing so sharply that even the cost of basic utilities has risen by nearly 30% in the last 12 months. There are growing fears that the economy is poised to fall into recession. And now, at a time when Americans are fighting to keep roofs over their heads and feed their families, Congress's plan is to authorize a record-setting $838.8 billion in spending to the Pentagon, nearly $40 billion more than what the military asked for.
American taxpayers should be angry. They are angry. Many are not only angry, they are incensed, and they are protesting. But unfortunately, too many elected representatives in this country aren't listening to their constituents. They're listening to the representatives and the lobbyists of the military-industrial complex, such as Lockheed Martin, Raytheon, Boeing, and General Electric. So when you have those companies and so many others that are pouring millions and millions and millions of dollars into the political campaigns of members of Congress and members of the Senate and the president, when they are pouring millions of dollars into their political campaigns, when they spend just an inordinate amount of time on Capitol Hill lobbying for their interests, then you're going to wind up with policies and programs that are sending money to the Pentagon instead of sending money into states for schools and retirement programs and the other types of social welfare programs that are needed in this country.
The U.S. has been fighting wars constantly since invading Afghanistan in 2001. This nonstop warfare has, however, come at the expense of American citizens and taxpayers. But why does the U.S. pursue war strategies, like in Ukraine and many other parts of the world, when its own citizens are suffering so immensely?
The U.S. Congress is on track to give the Pentagon $37 billion more than what the military asked for. And this comes while Congress could use this money to pay for a variety of things Americans desperately need right now, like school lunches, affordable housing, and utility assistance programs. Even just lowering taxes by that amount or giving this money directly to the American people could put more than $100 in the pocket of every single American at a time when they desperately need it. Not only would spending in such ways benefit the individuals and communities that receive them, it would also help revitalize the U.S. economy and make it more equitable to boot. As has been well documented, defense spending is one of the least economically productive ways the government can spend its money. Spending on education, healthcare, and lowering taxes, for example, have all been shown to create more and higher-paying jobs. So why is Congress poised to give government contractors the biggest taxpayer-funded payday they've ever received, despite the heavy economic implications that the move has on the country?
Well, the reason that the United States government is pursuing war strategies is because America is still an imperial hegemon. And so you have people like Tony Blinken and Avril Haines, Samantha Power, Jake Sullivan, Victoria Nuland, that are influencing decision makers in policy to try to start fights with Russia, try to start conflicts with China, start to continue to try to start conflicts with Iran to justify this immense military spending.
Pentagon contractors invest heavily in efforts to get more taxpayer money. They've spread their influence and money around the lobbyists, PR firms, and think tanks to ensure that the money is funneled in their way. In short, this is the military-industrial complex, and it is working overtime to raise the Pentagon budget at taxpayers' expense. And while much of Washington is on the racket and will also profit from this wasteful government spending, it's Americans struggling to keep the lights on who will pay the price.
And that is for World News. It's bye-bye for now.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Insight. Welcome to Insight. On this episode, we will be discussing Iran-Russia relations with Russian Ambassador to Iran, Levan Jagarian. But first, let's take a look at this brief analysis.
Iran and Russia are entering into a new strategic era in their relationship. The West's sanctions and overreactions, and its failure to isolate Russia following the war in Ukraine, has resulted in a strategic reorientation of Russia towards the East and South, which includes Iran. Iran itself is taking full advantage of a new emerging multipolar world order and declining U.S. power, and is enhancing its strategic relations with emerging powers from around the world, from China in East Asia to Venezuela in South America. After all, Iranians witnessed the failure of the JCPOA process and the failure of the nearly 30-year attempt by certain Western-oriented Iranian elites to create rapprochement with the West, only to be embarrassingly rejected by the U.S. itself. Iran is confidently pursuing its national interests with its non-Western neighbors in Asia and friends and allies around the world, and closing the book on strategic rapprochement with the West. After a period of naivety and sophomoric false hopes about the West and America among Iranian and Russian elites in the 1990s and early 21st century, everyone in Iran and Russia has now witnessed the fundamental enmity of American and Western elites to the very existence of an independent and powerful Iran and Russia, which can effectively contain, roll back, and expel America from Eurasia as it tries to maintain its fast-fading claims to global hegemony. Iran and Russia have made a good start into this new strategic era. However, a number of issues remain to be resolved, particularly in the field of trade and economics. Once these issues are resolved and Iran and Russia sign the strategic agreement that is currently being finalized, Zbigniew Brzezinski's and America's nightmare scenario of the strategic alignment of Iran, Russia and China will be complete, moving the world faster into the post-American era of contemporary human history.
Ambassador Jagarian, thank you so much for joining us on Insight. As you know, our program is more of a conversation. Yeah. We want to get into the issues in a more deep fashion. We want to talk about it more from a historic, strategic perspective. And so with that in mind, there's a lot of things we need to cover in our conversation. Well, Mr. Ambassador, it seems to me if we examine this behavior after the Cold War, we see that the West, according to the old plan from the 19th century, Halford Mackinder, talking about never allowing Russia and, for example, Germany to have good relations, always having these buffer states, one time against Russia, one time against Germany. So we see that they're effectively what they're doing is they are weaponizing the most extreme chauvinistic nationalistic elements in all the countries.
Yes, so
it's not the case that everybody in Latvia or in Estonia is like this.
Yes.
Or everybody in Ukraine. I'm talking about the Ukraine, it's not the Russian.
Of course. Sure.
So what they do is they go after the worst people and they create an atmosphere which then causes, and all of it is to destabilize Russia.
So this is under this false under influence of this false American propaganda, which is, I mean, circulated by Voice of America, Radio Europe, Free Europe, and BBC, so-called independent, or as I call it, Radio Yesterday, from Prague, or day before yesterday, whatever, Iran International. And
because, as you mentioned, there are different historic understandings of what happened.
Yeah.
So they are emphasizing those issues that are always anti-Russian. They're never talking about the other issues. They're never talking about that, you know, you had people like you mentioned the Nazis in Ukraine joining with the Nazis to fight against their own homeland and their own people. We see people attacking Orthodox churches now.
So
these are the things that maybe, as you're mentioning, it's a propaganda issue. But don't you think Russia could do a little bit more in terms of...
And we are doing more. We try to do more. And, of course, but anyway, you know, they banned all our possibilities to work abroad. But, you know, Russia today, Sputnik, it created a huge problems for us.
Again, you're welcome to the club.
Yeah. Freedom of speech.
Exactly.
Welcome. So that's why I call them no communists. And as a former communist, I'm very happy to see a lot of new comrades.
Yes. Okay, Mr. Ambassador, very good. So let's move what we were talking about previously. So you see the future of Russia in this new... First of all, how do you see this new multipolar, this new emerging global...
Americans must forget about their dream to be to establish a unipolar world.
Right.
China, Russia, Iran, and other friendly countries will do their utmost to resist, and we are in favor of a multipolar world.
Exactly.
And it's reality. An inevitable process. No other choice.
It's interesting you mentioned that. You know, Spitir Brzezinski, in his final book, he talks about that the worst-case scenario for the Americans is is the strategic unity between China, Russia, and Iran. He very cleverly doesn't mention India because they always want to use India as a wedge in Asia. But so it's very clear when somebody like Brzezinski talks about this, then this becomes clear to us why they are doing these things.
Sure.
So on the one side, they are pressuring Russia with Ukraine. They did it also the coup attempt in Kazakhstan, I think it was.
In January,
they're doing all these things. In West Asia, they're pressuring Iran with Israel, with all this.
Taiwan.
Of course. And in East Asia, they're pressuring China with Taiwan and with the Quad and, you know, the
AUKUS.
Because a lot of people don't realize, you know, the American troops that are in Korea, they're very close to Beijing.
South Korea.
In South Korea, exactly. In South Korea, they're very close to Beijing. This is not something that's because of the North. It's because of China. Okay, so with that in mind, let's talk a little bit about this new emerging strategic relationship between Iran and Russia. There's many aspects to it. It's at the beginning of it. I think it was a good start. I remember we had the trip by President Putin to Iran a number of years ago, which was a very good, successful trip, and where President Putin and the leader of the Islamic Revolution had a good meeting. President Putin gave as a present one of these old Qurans that was in Russia, which was very nice. And I believe that maybe at that point we see the beginnings of this issue, this kind of newer relationship emerging. Of course, at that time, we didn't have the issue of JCPOA. We didn't have the issue, or we had it, but it wasn't as prominent, maybe. We didn't have the issue of the problems that have occurred after the special military operation. But then with the new administration in Iran, the 13th administration, we had President Raisi going to Moscow. We had the Minister of Energy coming here. We had the recent, Russian National Day here with the Minister of Oil here also. So if you could please give us a little bit of an insight into what will it take, what is happening, and what will it take for us to get to this, inshallah, as we say again, this time where we can sign that strategic agreement as Iran signed with China, as they recently signed with Venezuela. What are the issues? What are some of the barriers? From your perspective, what do we need to do in terms of economics, security, culture, whatever it is that you think that should be mentioned here?
First of all, thanks for this very interesting and a good question. I have been serving here as ambassador for more than 10 years and a half.
Yes.
And for me, it's a big honor to represent such a great country like Russian Federation in such a great country like the Islamic Republic of Iran. You just mentioned President Putin's visit to Iran. I was witnessing and participating in this visit three times, 2015, 2017, 2018, and I was present in his meetings with His Excellency, the spiritual leader of the Islamic Republic of Iran, Sayyid Ali Khamenei. I would like to express my respect to His Excellency. And I was witnessing the very warm atmosphere, very friendly. Mm-hmm. And such good personal relations between our leaders, they are very helpful for us.
Yes.
Diplomats, high-ranking officials from both countries to fulfill, all the tasks we have got, instructions from our leaders. It's very important. Now, with the 13th government of the Islamic Republic of Iran, we can say that we have opened a new page on our bilateral relations. And initially, the Iranian government, President Raisi, expressed his will to develop much more relations with neighboring countries and with Eastern countries. The same are for us. So we have similar goals, ideas. And you mentioned this exchange of delegations between the two countries. From the very beginning of the year in spring, a lot of Iranian hierarchic delegations visited Russian Federation. And Mr. Oji was there, Minister of Transportation was there, Mr. Rustam Qasemi, Vice President Surena Sattari was there. And finally, on the 25th of May, a huge, big Russian delegation in head by Deputy Prime Minister Alexander Novak visited Iran. And he had many meetings here, very fruitful. And he was accompanied by six vice ministers of different ministries, economic, financial, transportation, atomic. And we will continue our consultations on different levels to develop our fruitful cooperation in mutual interest. I'm very, very, very optimistic. In autumn this year, we will conduct, we will hold the next session of our Joint Economic Commission in the Russian Federation. Now it's our turn to host it. I do believe that it will open new prospects for our bilateral relations. Last year, the volume of our trade was $4 billion. It's nothing.
Yeah.
Taking into consideration our capabilities, it's nothing. I mentioned $4 billion, but we will do our utmost.
Yes.
To remove U.S. dollars from our bilateral trade, not only with the Islamic Republic of Iran. And we'll do our utmost to use as much as possible our national currencies,
yes,
which is very important. And we will help us to bypass all these sanctions, illegitimate sanctions. But in terms of sanctions, they have imposed sanctions against Russia, but it was for the first time against Soviet Union. Jackson Vanik.
Yes, yes.
But we will never ask them, please lift the sanctions. It's up to them. If they want to lift sanctions, they are welcome. If they don't want to lift the sanctions, we will impose counter-sanctions. Sanctions, counter-sanctions. Sanctions, counter-sanctions. It is a lose-lose game. But it's up to them to decide.
Mr. Ambassador, it's interesting you mentioned the trade. We had one of our guests in the previous programs, in one of our previous episodes in this program, we had Professor Sergei Glazyev, who is a famous Russian economist. He was also advisor, I believe, to the to the presidency, and he very nicely and very technically explained that they are working in Russia on a plan to have a international trade currency to replace the dollar.
Yes, yes, yes.
Not to replace the national currencies. In fact, the national currencies can be the backing of this international trade currency. Again, something that is proposed by Russian academics. And also using the vast natural resources of Eurasia, of Russia, Iran, China, and other countries who want to join as a backing for this to replace the dollar. So, this issue that Iran has been talking about for years, because we understood the difficulty of being living under this dollar hegemony and not being able to, you know, do the most basic things.
Unfortunately.
Yes, and we had recently also an interview with Professor Duhan from the UN. She's from Belarus.
Yes.
Talking about one of the main things in her report was the fact that this banking sanctioning and the sanctioning of and needing to use the dollar is an issue. So, in other words, what I want to hear from you, maybe if you can say it very clearly or very without, you know. So the goal or the plan for the Russian Federation is to move away from the dollar.
Yes. We want to remove dollar. We try to our utmost to do that. But it's their initiative.
Right.
Yeah. They decided to steal our money.
Exactly.
As well as they decided to steal your oil.
Exactly.
Don't surprise.
So this ruins their own credibility because nobody then trusts putting the money in those banks.
Yes, no trust.
So this is they shot themselves in the foot, as they say.
Yes.
They shouldn't
have. I'm sorry, you mentioned the issue of treaty between Russia and Iran.
Yes.
We've got the draft last year.
The strategic agreement.
Yes, we work on it, but it's a little bit long process. But we will try to speed it up, because we must ask the opinion of Russian different ministries.
Exactly.
inside foreign ministry, outside foreign ministry. It's also always on the agenda of our bilateral contacts. And last time when Mr. Amir Abdullahian, foreign minister of the Islamic Republic of Iran, talked to his Russian colleague, Mr. Sergei Lavrov, he also touched upon the issue. And we are working on it very hardly, and we are in regular contacts with our Iranian friends.
It's interesting you mentioned that. We had another interview. I'm sorry I keep mentioning other interviews, but about Russia, we had actually quite a few interesting interviews, both with Foreign Minister Amir Abdullahian. In the interview, you also mentioned the relationship with Russia, but also with former Iranian ambassador, Mr. Sajjadi, who was a former Iranian ambassador in Russia. And he, because he's worked on this issue a lot, he talked about that the Iranian and Russian economies are very complementary to each other. On the one hand, we have a very powerful oil and energy sector that the cooperation could be could literally change the entire global energy markets if there's a cooperation. In terms of technology, both countries very advanced in these areas, not necessarily needing the West to give them any technology, and there could be a lot of things. In terms of security, we talked a little bit about this. I think this is something that we don't mention enough, but it's good if we mention it, that we had a very successful security and military cooperation in Syria.
Yeah, yes.
That, you know, we have to say this, Iran and Russia defeated the Takfiris.
Thanks to us.
To the terrorists, together.
Thanks together.
Yes.
Russian and Iranians,
exactly.
First of all.
This is something, you know, because we have this problem in Iran, I wanted to also get your opinion on this, that we have this old tradition in Iran of anti-Russian.
Yes, I know. I know it very well.
Yes, I
yes. feel it.
Of course, there is a history for a lot of Iranians as it relates to the Tsarist Russian era,
yes,
as it
yes.
relates to the Soviet Union. These are not things that we are denying. Just so that people who are listening know for sure, my great-grandfather was killed in the war with the Russians. So it's not something most Iranian families have these issues. But the issue is that Russia is different. It's not the Soviet Union. It's not the Tsarist Russian era. But we still see that there is any excuse that they can use, whether it's, you know, the Minister of Oil standing this way, or you standing there.
I'm standing this way.
Yeah, exactly.
Or this way.
Exactly. Is there something, do you think, that is the Russian Federation, is the Russian embassy, what should we do to work on this issue? I'm saying this, you know, connecting it with this very successful year-long cooperation that we had, where we gave a lot of... sorry, I need to mention this. This idea, for example, Shahid Soleimani, General Soleimani. So one of the things that he did in Syria is he led the operation to free the Russian pilot himself as the commanding general. You know, these are important things. These are not small things. What can we do to mention the reality of what it is today, as opposed to the propaganda that they're doing?
You know, you just quite correctly mentioned that there are some people with anti-Russian sentiments. Of course, they have the right to have their own opinion.
Yeah, of course.
And we cannot impose by force our opinion. They have their understanding, we have their understanding. And the best way is to meet with each other and discuss.
Yes.
Discuss. But it was in the history, in the past.
Exactly.
We can't live only with these thoughts which are connecting to the past. We must look in the future, to the future. But and to the nowadays, what's going on? And you know, in terms of JCPOA, we always were standing with Iran. And right now, do you remember this resolution, anti-Iranian resolution,
yes,
condemning Iran,
which
was quite unnecessary.
Yes,
it was a very wrong decision. Mm-hmm. And who voted against? Russia and China.
Exactly.
That's why the question is to those anti-Russian people. Why do you keep silence?
Of course.
Please.
Yes.
Tell something. And we will continue to support our Iranian friends to get out of the deadlock. But now we cannot mediate between Iranians and Americans like it was before. Now we don't have contact with them.
Yeah, because the Americans cut
the Europeans.
It.
Yeah, they cut. But anyway, it's not...
Ambassador Ulyanov was...
Very fruitful,
yes.
Very useful. And we sincerely try to be helpful. That's why I'm very, very sorry that they don't want to accept it. They don't want to accept.
Right. They don't want to accept the reality of what it is.
Yes,
they're stuck
yes.
in the past, like you said. They're stuck in the past.
And yeah, they yes. are under huge influence of this anti-Iranian radio, like I mentioned, BBC Farsi.
Yes.
My best regards to them. Radio Diruz. Best regards to them. Iran International. the fabrics who just, create, yes, or produce fake news.
They're lying.
Yeah.
It's lies.
Yeah, and lying. And because, you know, my president said that Americans managed to create a huge, huge empire of lies.
Yes, yes, I read. Yes. That's what it is.
And they continue to lie, and it's very counterproductive.
I think this goes back to what you were talking about in terms of the Europeans not defending their pragmatic interests. So,
sorry, unfortunately.
So we see the same thing maybe in Iran and Russia sometimes, that there are pragmatic interests. It's in the real interests of Iran and Russia. And people forget, Iran and Russia are neighbors. They're not. Yes. It's not like Russia is not the other side of the world. So we have the Caspian Sea between us, but we're neighbors in terms of maritime neighbors. We have, you know, how far is it from Anzali to Astrakhan? It's not that far. We can do a lot of things there. We have the corridor going. So it's in our interest to, particularly given the hostility that we're experiencing and this irrational hostility. It's not something that you can say, okay, you know, we can understand everybody has their own interest. It's this, like I said, I believe it's this essential, being essentially against the existence of these two.
But we need some more opportunities here in Iran.
Right.
To conduct our activity in cultural level,
Mr. Messer, we're not worried about upsetting anyone. Yes. Please tell us
A few days ago, four ladies, young ladies, students, came to our embassy. The ladies who learned Russian language, who like Russian literature, Russian poems, I gave them, handed over diplomas. And during our National Day, you just quite correctly mentioned Mrs. Marzia Yahyapur came here, mm-hmm, and we asked our president to reward her with the Medal of Pushkin. Mm-hmm. President Putin signed a decree, and she was rewarded this Medal of Pushkin. And for me, it was a big honor to hand it over to her in presence of Mr. OG,
yes,
Minister of Oil, and he's a co-chairperson of our Joint Economic Commission. So we have a lot of friends here. But we need some other opportunities. We don't have cultural center, and the agreement.
Just to explain for our audience. So countries have cultural centers in different countries.
Yes, yes, yes.
So Iran has a cultural center in.
Not only one, but they have in Moscow and some other cities have the opportunity to conduct very important, very fruitful cultural activities,
yes,
to spread Persian language, which is, yes, very popular in the Russian Federation. Because, you know, all my staff members in Iran, in General Consulate in Isfahan, in Rasht, at the embassy, almost all of them, they have well command in Persian language, yes, which is very important.
Of course.
Very important.
Yes.
It makes our job very easier.
Exactly.
And we also, last year in April, my Minister Lavrov and Mr. Zarif, former foreign minister, signed an agreement about the conditions of activity of our cultural centers. And we just would like to ask estimate Iranian Majlis to ratify.
So we're waiting for Majlis to ratify.
Yes, 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 yes.
Any other things that you think that we should maybe other issues from the Russian perspective that you feel are some things that you would want the Iranians to maybe.
You know, before 2018, a lot of Iranians visited Russian Federation, mm-hmm, especially 2018, Cop World, when,
yes,
Iranian team,
yes,
participated.
Yes, yes.
And they managed to visit different Russian cities, even Saransk,
yes,
in Mordovia, St. Petersburg, Kazan, and so on. I would like to see more Iranians in the Russian Federation.
What about Russians coming here?
Yeah, also to see a lot of Russians to come to Iran.
Because, you know, Iran is a very culturally...
Yeah, yeah.
You know, because Iran can never really be a substitute for some of the European countries or others, because we have our own culture,
we have our own.
But in terms of culture and in terms of family trips and in terms of a family vacation.
Right now, Europe is closed for Russian tourists.
Exactly.
Fortunately.
Yes. For us also, it's better.
Yes, yes. If they don't want to accept Russian tourists, it's up to them. It's also, they damage their own interests. That's why our tourists will go to the east. Inside Russia, CIS countries, Iran, China, India, Emirates.
Mr. Masrur, we don't have a lot of time, but just one issue that I hear sometimes from some Iranian side talking about. They're talking about that the port facilities in the Russian side of the Caspian are not maybe, not that on the Iranian side this issue exists as well, but the idea that if we're going to have this increase of trade and relations and this back and forth. We need to work a little bit on this issue of the different
quite right
ports in the Caspian. If you could, please.
Yes, I completely agree with you. And recently there was also, when Mr. Novak was here, the governor of Astrakhan region, Mr. Babushkin, and a few days ago he hosted Mr. Fattah.
Yes.
Yeah. The chief of this Mostasefan Foundation.
Yes, yes, yes.
And we are working on that in this regard.
Okay, very good.
Also, very important is to make some technical issues, some technical works in Volga-Don channel, yes, which is connecting, yes, Black Sea and Caspian Sea.
Exactly.
That, yeah, we are working on it. Yes. Astrakhan, Olya, which is also just operated by Iranian friends.
Very good. Mr. Ambassador, we're coming to the end. If there's anything else you would like to mention that we didn't talk about, please.
I would like only to express my respect to the friendly Iranian people. I know that we are now, Russia and Iran, in a difficult position as a result of the sanctions, but we will overcome all these problems, all the difficulties, working together. All the best and best regards, best wishes to the friendly Iranian people.
Thank you, Mr. Ambassador. Thank you
very
for joining
much.
Us.
Thank you.
Until the next time.
Thank you.
Thank you. So what insight did we gain from our conversation with Ambassador Jagarian? It's clear that the Western reactions, sanctions, and general hostility to all things Russian following the war in Ukraine have not isolated Russia, but have in fact resulted in Russia strategically reorienting itself towards Asia and the global South and away from the West. Russia is putting all its energy in cultivating the relations it has with major Asian powers such as China, India and Iran, as well as the relations it has with countries in Africa and Latin America. Relations with the US is clearly a closed matter for the foreseeable future, but it seems that Russia has not completely given up on Europe, expressing the hope that the leaders there will eventually come to their senses and defend their own national interests instead of blindly following the US and pushing their societies off the precipice, citing Hungary as a positive example of a country that puts its national interests before subservience to the US. In terms of Iran-Russia relations, it is entering a new strategic era in all areas, with the focus on the expansion of economic relations and trade, the use of national currencies for trade, and the eventual replacement of the dollar with a new international trade currency. We are moving towards the post-American era and a new world order where Russia will be an important pillar. It seems that with every passing day, we are getting closer to Zbigniew Brzezinski and America's nightmare of the strategic alignment of Russia, Iran, and China, due in part to America's own irrational and short-sighted policies and strategies. Thank you for joining us on this episode. Until the next time on Insight.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
Fiqh or jurisprudence is an Islamic knowledge and is ranked
The Holy Prophet of Islam is the example
of
self-purification is the most significant
factor.
Imamat is a living principle in the history of Islam and Shiism.
This is Ulama Speech, the best selection of the speeches of prominent Shia scholars.
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful, welcome to another episode of Ulama's Speech. In this episode, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a short speech by Hujjatul Islam Nasir Rafi'i. Please stay tuned.
کنم ما به 4-5 شکل نسبت به قرآن ادهان و سستی داریم.
We people take the Holy Quran lightly for several reasons. Sometimes we cannot recite the Quran properly. Now in this case, we can see many students and experts with various skills who are unable to read out the Quran properly. Dear brothers and sisters, just look at the last verse of Surah Muzammil to see how important the position of the Quran is. In this verse, Allah recalls people one time about Salat and one time about Zakat, but two times about the Holy Quran. The exact wording is this: so recite as much of the Quran as is feasible.
این کلمه تو این آیه دو بار تکرار شده. نماز یه بار، اقیم الصلاة.
This sentence is repeated two times in this verse of the Quran. Now, dear youths, this verse and other verses show us the importance of reciting the Holy Quran. We also can listen to the recorded audio of the Quran in our cars or houses, and gradually we can memorize the Holy Quran. Even when we are in our workplace, whether a shop or a company, we can listen to the Holy Quran recitation, and it is very good if we listen to its translation in our mother tongue too. Thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of Ulama's Speech, which was the English translation of a short speech by Hujjatul Islam Nasir Rafi'i. To find out more about this program, log on to our website www.parstoday.com Call of Islam page. We'll leave you in Allah's care and goodbye. Thank you.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.